I'd like to open the session, the April 4th, 2013 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. Good morning to everyone. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3364. Beth, if you could please tell us what that bill is about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3364 would establish the Integrated Pest Management Coordinating Committee, specify membership and the purpose of the committee, and all of its purposes. There is no revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact. There's a dash one amendment which replaces the original measure.
All right, thank you very much. And welcome to our colleague, Representative Kenny Geyer. Before I open it up for your testimony, I understand from Representative Clem there are some folks for a couple of bills that for technical reasons due to amendments and various other reasons, we're going to have to carry over two bills. One would be House Bill 2700. The other one will be 2032. So if you're here for those bills, we will probably see you back on Tuesday, April 9th, the date to which I am carrying those bills over, and apologize for any inconvenience. And with that, Representative Kenny Geyer, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and colleagues on the committee. My first time in front of this committee. It's an honor. I am Melissa Kenny Geyer. I represent House District 46, which is parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland. And I'm here today to talk to you about House Bill 3364, and specifically the Dash 1 Amendment, which is a friendly gut and stuff of the original bill. IPM, as you know, I think you've been looking at this a lot in your committee, it aims to reduce pests in our state while at the same time protecting our natural resources and our human health. There was a big attempt toward IPM when this was a big area, a big field of study many, many years ago, over a decade ago, and Oregon was very active in that attempt. But the focus about a decade ago shifted more toward the invasive species. There was a big concern about that. We had been doing pretty well in IPM, and we looked more specifically at invasive species, formed the Invasive Species Council. I think of invasive species as a little bit like the emergency room, really getting on top of some of those species that are exploding right away. And integrated pest management is a little bit more primary care. That's kind of my layperson's view of it. Both of them, of course, have a big eye toward prevention and how do you prevent pests in the first place? How do you contain them? But while agencies have been meeting regularly for invasive species around the Invasive Species Council over the last decade and have made progress on their own in their own departments in integrated pest management, there are some recognized gaps. Paul Jepson, who is the state coordinator for IPM, will be giving you a PowerPoint presentation that I believe is being loaded right now onto OLIS for a study that he and Lisa DeBerguer from the Invasive Species Council did in 2010 and introduced to the legislature in 2011. We've been asking a lot of our private sector in the integrated pest management area, and this bill focuses primarily on the public sector. It aims to increase coordination among state agencies and universities to enhance the state's ability to set metrics, gather and analyze data, to measure our progress toward those metrics, share best practices through information and training, and allow an opportunity for public input. We've had incredible cooperation among many partners at the table. We've met several times. I want to do a huge shout out to Gabriella Goldfarb, the Deputy Natural Resources Advisor to the Governor. The Governor's office has been really helpful in bringing people together who represent the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon Department of Forestry, Oregon Department of Transportation, the DAS, Department of State Lands, the Invasive Species Council, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, Beyond Toxics, and the IPM State Coordinator, Paul Jepson, who will be up here next. We have gone through 11 different versions. We've had several meetings, some of us all together, many individual meetings with state agencies. We've had 11 different versions of the legislative concept before it finally went to the Dash 1. So it's 95% there. There's once the Dash 1 came out a couple days ago, there were a few little tweaks that we will be making to it, but this represents, I think, primarily the concept that we're putting forward today. So with that, I'd like to turn it to Paul Jepson. I know he's got a plane to catch in Eugene in a couple hours. So thank you so much. And are there any quick questions? before moving on?
Just a comment, Representative, the tremendous leadership that you have provided. And I recognize, as you said, that you had the tremendous cooperation from so many different people and agencies, but that cooperation probably had nowhere to go without the leadership that you have provided.
Well, again, I have to say the governor's office was incredible in pulling all this together. A lot of meetings that I wasn't even a part of, so I've been happy to be associated with this and really happy to see the level of cooperation that we've had. So thank you so much.
Great job. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for accommodating this early. I very much appreciate that. My name is Paul Jepson. I'm the state IPM coordinator. I've been in Oregon now for 17 years. I'm a fairly newly minted American citizen with all the things that go along with that. And I've been state IPM coordinator since 2002. We work with farmers throughout the Pacific Northwest, as well as nationally and even globally. And we have a very extensive program. I'm assistant director of the regional IPM Center for the 14 Western States and Pacific Island Territories. I'm a past member of the National IPM Committee. I direct a regional invasive species management program. Our center provides the mathematical and modeling underpinning for the national biosecurity framework in the USA. And I'm currently on a federal crop protection committee looking at ways of revising the federal budget to better serve the country's needs. I'm just one of a large number of people in Oregon that have a pretty extraordinary background, really, including colleagues at ODA, Department of Transport, Department of Forestry, and others that share this immense challenge of managing pests in one of the most invadable places on the planet. It's not just nice for people like me to come and live in Oregon. It's a great place for those pest diseases and weeds, and so it's a constant challenge for us. And this bill, we feel, offers a way forward in just improving our capacities. And feeling naked without a PowerPoint display, I thought I would show you a few slides. This, I believe, is going to be put on your system in a while or circulated. I'm sorry it's a little bit large. I'm just going to show you a few slides. But on the rear end of this are a whole number of slides that capture a survey that Lisa de Brecaire and I conducted in 2010 that was reported to the legislature on December 14th of that year. And I'm just going to summarize some of that because it could clarify some of the reasoning behind this proposal. Summary, really, how is IPM coordinated between federal agencies? What happens at the national level? Because I think there's something interesting to learn there. Are there good local examples of legislative actions that you have taken as a legislature that have enabled greater cooperation that we intend by this committee and shown progress in IPM? What does the IPM bill set out to do? What kind of education and IPM resources might be mobilized by OSU as just one of the partners here, I hasten to add? And then does OSU support this, and might it invest some resources in the success of this committee? Clearly, if the answer is no to some of those questions, we're in trouble. But I've described that as a set of questions we're going to try and answer. Interestingly, nationally, after 9/11, there was a huge effort nationally just to check that we were able to cope with potential biosecurity threats. And as of part of that, we also reviewed our ability nationally in all our constituent states to manage invasive pest diseases and weeds. And a decision was made at the time that there was insufficient cooperation and understanding and even common language between agencies that would enable progress. So a national IPM committee was set up in 2002. And this basically incorporates membership from a number of organizations, including IPM coordinators such as myself, federal agencies, government departments, funding agencies, very similar to the makeup of our proposed committee in our state here. This committee has really achieved some enormous strides in improvements in impacts of programs and the focus of programs, the efficiency of pest management nationally, and its effectiveness. It's affected agricultural applications of IPM, natural resource applications, applications in the built environment and for sensitive subpopulations, and even gets involved in things like malaria risk management for our troops overseas. So this is a pretty big deal. The group realized very early on that setting up some metrics and some common language with which we could discuss IPM across all these different applications was a good thing to do. And basically, through a very transparent process, we now have one meeting a year, and we're able to discuss IPM with some common sense of what we're trying to achieve. HV 3364 basically establishes an analogous forum or platform for similar progress in our state. A good example of local partnerships that you should feel good about as a legislature is the Oregon School IPM law that was signed in a previous legislature and came into full force in 2012. Actually, the need for this became far more apparent after the bill was passed than beforehand. Its success, as we're discovering, depends on effective partnerships between agencies and many different associations, and as well as the school teachers and custodians themselves. All the timelines have been met or exceeded. Metrics have been developed, which we'd love to be able to report back to you. School IPM is becoming a reality now, I would say. It's not just a box that's ticked or a theory. You know, integrated pest management is something I learned about in college. It's just a theory, isn't it? No, it's what we do in practice. It shows we were right to expect more from our state and from our school system. And the idea that someone could sit here 4 years ago and say, we're already doing it, the bill is not needed, really there's no sense that that was a realistic thing to say at the time. Certainly we've proved otherwise now. So my colleague Tim Stock, who prepared this slide, is the guy looking into this cupboard with a torch. We must stop him doing that all the time, I guess. But you know, asthma costs about $8 billion in lost school attendance a year. It's the number one cause of absenteeism. Mice are the most common asthma trigger. An online survey revealed that we analyzed and has come to light since the bill was passed has shown that of 184 out of 197 school districts in Oregon, 53 of them reported that mice were a common pest, which suggests that IPM at the time either wasn't being used or wasn't working. Since then, however, subject to the requirements of the law, 182 out of 197 school districts have now been trained in IPM. 75% of them are showing they're using IPM plans, and we'll be reporting back to you fairly soon, we hope, on the effectiveness of there of suppressing mouse populations, as an example. But the collaboration that's required here, the degree of effort it took to get people to talk with a common language about specific themes in IPM across parks and buildings and all the other applications of IPM in schools. It's taken a number of years, but we're really getting there. What does this bill try to do in that context of partnership, discussion, metrics, and progress? It responds to specific needs within agencies that we identified in 2010. It coordinates responses as a collaborative interagency activity. There's no threat to any individual agency or its programs here. We just feel that working together, sharing problems, we're going to come up with better solutions, as is always the case. We develop comparable metrics between our different applications, and so we can integrate results across a number of statutes and agencies. We've got a mechanism for capacity building and resourcing, which I'll touch upon briefly. We can exchange ideas, professional expertise, access other relevant networks and working groups and resources. And we can enable recognition of excellence where it exists, because I believe we do that too rarely in our state. And we've got some absolute exemplars that are nationally and internationally known in our state agencies for their effectiveness in delivering good IPM programs. And finally, we acknowledge that pest management technologies, capacities, and approaches are constantly evolving, and that we all need a retread occasionally. So that's it. Provides us with a capacity to rebuild the program on a reasonable way, not waiting for an emergency to occur that tells us we should have been doing something in a different way. So I've gone through the first three bullet points. I've just got another two to briefly summarize, if that's okay.
Please do.
What kind of education IPM resources might be mobilized by OSU, and then does OSU support this, and might it invest in the resources? I'm just going to show you a few slides of what farmers and private citizens, as it were, do in Oregon in IPM, because we've got a leading state in this regard that's recognized nationally. We won an award. The International Award for Effective IPM Programs was delivered to Oregon this time last year in Tennessee. OSU has a number of education resources. For example, if you go to this website, you can see we're starting a new residential course program each year now, which we believe will be very successful. So this is a venue where we might discuss specific applications in IPM. We also have multiple partnerships. Here's a number of organizations, universities, state and federal agencies, private businesses that work together in a regional network to build good weather data that farmers need to analyze the likelihood of pest outbreaks. Working more cooperatively with state agencies that manage pests out of doors, we should be able to bring to bear the capacities this group has enabled without any cost, but just through cooperation and working out how to do these things. So here, for example, on the left is a map of likely survival over the winter of this terrible little pest, spotted wing Drosophila, that's affecting all of our lovely blueberries at the moment. The hotter the color, the greater the degree of overwintering, and the more likely you're going to get an outbreak. However, and it doesn't show very clearly in the middle slide, we've got some urban heat islands in our valley, and we've got warm places that our modeling now enables us to show that there are patches, if you look at the figure on the right, that don't appear in the figure on the left, where we'll get zones of higher overwintering survival of pests. It's this type of modeling capacity, skill, which OSU would try and offer to this group and bring to bear, just as other agencies would offer their ideas and technologies to us. And you'll notice I'm resisting the opportunity to note about a patch of hot air residing somewhere in the middle of the Willamette Valley, but there is actually a warm patch around Salem where overwintering survival of spotted wing Drosophila is liable to be rather greater. And so this is a utility where there's a lot of technologies, cooperators, networks that we can build into this effective process if we just have a forum for cooperation. Farmers in Oregon, just look at the blue figure, have gone from 4,000 uses of these weather data systems a year to 18,000 uses just in 3 years. It's going through the roof, the use of these technologies. And here at one of our field stations in Milton Freewater, for example, are some the farmers get direct access to the models for the diseases like fire blight and codling moth that they need to manage. And they can also see, using a map, what the distribution of pests are in their fields and farms. I'm coming right to the end now, Mr. Chair. But, I mean, the point of this is that technology is advancing enormously, and what constituted IPM in 1993 or 2003 is completely different to the capacities we have now. And through the use of these technologies, we've been able to demonstrate that pesticide residues, for example, in Oregon streams in the Walla Walla Basin have declined below the acute and chronic water quality standards for chlorpyrifos and organophosphate pesticides, simply by doing things better, using new technologies, having farmers willingly adopt these as voluntary partners in our program. I'll move on from that. I just will say, in summary, a 2010 survey identified diverse pest problems that the state tackles. There's more than 50 statutory authorities for pest management. There are numerous models for IPM implementation. Some of the definitions are rather obsolete, we feel. There's diverse language about IPM and performance metrics, variable frequencies, currencies, and modes of review, significant expenditures, and of course some evidence for some fantastic impacts, but limited and variable training to keep up to speed with where the new technologies are. This bill will enable us to address some of these issues gradually, as resources allow, within a cost-effective resource plan. OSU has agreed to commit 10% of my time to making this process work, and it's agreed to match a very small requested amount of $25,000 per biennium in order to enable some of capacity building and training to be taken forward. I'm also applying for a grant to double that amount, a further $50,000 a biennium, to provide a server for collecting data, providing maps of the results, and enabling attendance at conferences, essential meetings, and some training, which we believe could carry us forward. So thank you very much for your time today. I hope that's given you some clarity. For those of you on the panel here, the rest of the slides, which I didn't intend to show, are a summary of the report that we provided to the legislature, and I'm effectively tabling this again for you to see, to reveal the answers that we received from the agencies that justify the inclusion of this bill. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, any questions or comments for Mr. Jepson before he has to jet out of here?
I've got until 9 o'clock.
So all right. Cutting it close nonetheless.
Yeah.
I'm not seeing any. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. A question, is Tom Wolf in the room here? There you are, back there. Tom, how close are you to needing to? Okay, all right. With that, I'm going to call up Representative Gorsuch, please. Good morning, sir. Welcome to our committee.
Oh, thank you. And I'm running a little late. I apologize for that. But glad to be here before the committee. I am approaching this testimony this morning as, good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Gorsuch, state representative from House District 49, which includes the cities of Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and Gresham, and it includes my college, Mount Hood Community College. I'm testifying today from my perspective as a geography teacher at a college, and I don't know if you know much about geography, but we tend to be relatively superficial, so this will be a very general sort of approach, if you know what I mean. So I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3364 because I believe that the system of integrated pest management is the best way forward for us. In the 1970s, we saw the beginnings of serious research on integrated pest management, or IPM. And as I'm sure you already saw with this previous speaker, the idea is to work on new and different ways to control pests of various kinds. This research has continued into the 1980s and on into the present. It's a multi-step process to control a pest situation in which a problem is assessed, evaluated, and then a solution is implemented with complementary actions. This is a system that allows us to adapt to different situations to find the best solution possible for the problem at hand. Lots of different solutions, and some of them are as simple as changing the way the landscape looks, planting plant-resistant varieties, using insect pheromones, the release of natural enemies, beneficial organisms, and so on. Integrated pest management, I believe, will allow us to address pest problems in a targeted way that allows us to choose the best solution for each individual situation, rather than our standard approach of the past, which has been usually to use just a chemical response. Chemicals have their place, but when we can use more natural alternatives, it's probably better for not only the critters in the environment, but the human beings there as well. So with that, I will thank you for the opportunity to testify and answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much. And questions for our colleague? All right. Representative Gorsuch, thank you very much. Appreciate your appearance.
No problem. Have a good day.
You too. With that, I am going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3364, and I'm going to temporarily open a public hearing on House Bill 3437. Beth?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3437 would require appointees to the Fish and Wildlife Commission to have held at least one of the following licenses in each of the 10 calendar years immediately preceding their appointment: a valid hunting license, a valid angling or shellfish license, or a commercial fishing license. There is a -2 amendment, which is in your packet, which would replace the original measure and require five members of the commission to have held at least one of the of those licenses I just mentioned in each of the five calendar years preceding their appointment. There's no revenue impact. There may be a fiscal impact.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. You have in front of you a proposal that has been talked about a lot with our sportsmen throughout the state of Oregon, and that is to have at least some members, if not all, people that do in fact practice hunting and fishing and trapping and commercial fishing in the state of Oregon, because they're the ones that are footing the bill for the wildlife to a large extent. I don't think that we should have the whole commission in itself be strictly people that have had possessed a license for 5 years. Originally, we were talked about 10. I thought about it. We went to 5. In fact, Chair Witt and I discussed this, and this is the outcome of our discussions. And I thank you, Representative. I think it behooves us to allow people to make decisions and make regulations on hunting, fishing, trapping, and commercial fishing to be people that do actively participate in it. You know, we talk a lot of people in this state about save this, save that, or against hunting, against fishing, or whatever. You know, it's the sportsmen are the ones that put in the money to enhance the herds. It's the sportsmen that put in the money to help restore salmon flows and steelhead. It's the sportsmen that care the most about trapping and hunting and fishing. We're the ones that actually put in a substantial amount of the foot the bill, and I guess sportsmen are what I call conservationists, because they do, in fact, care about the enhancement of herds, which right now we have some serious challenges ahead of us, and that is we have a declining mule deer and blacktail population, and in my opinion, although the Game Commission differs from it, I think we have a problem with our declining elk herds in population. Several factors to that, but this is a good step to start in to allow people to make decisions that actively are involved in what we do and the cause and effect. The wildlife belong to everyone in the state of Oregon, but the management comes under actually licenses and tags, which is a substantial amount of money. If you go down today, you'll pay $160-some for a sports package, and that's per person. We're footing the bill, so we should have input. And I feel very strongly that if we're going to appoint somebody to a commission, not only should they have a knowledge of it, maybe academically, but I think they should also have a working knowledge of it as well. I'll answer any questions. You guys have let me off easy here.
Representative Krieger.
Oh, I knew he wouldn't let me go.
I'll be real blunt. In recent years, and I won't say which agency, we have had people appointed who are clueless. And as a result of that, it takes years to get them informed online before they can really have a contribute with some knowledge to the process on a commission or board that they're on. And I don't know why we do that when we have hosts of people that have, or private citizens out here that have degrees in all of these issues, college degrees, actually practice hunting and fishing in the field, or even agriculture, forestry. These people are knowledgeable. A lot of them got degrees that are crossed over. And I think we need to tap into that and utilize it and not have the position become pawns for political agendas.
Thank you very much. Additional questions, Representative Reardon.
Thank you. Representative, I'm just curious. It seemed like the other day we had a hearing in here, and it was talking about the hatcheries, and there was a point made about, or discussion around, the need for scientists on that, or the need for science to understand the hatcheries in the fishing business. And if I recall, that we had the conversation was that there would be no requirement, I think, to have scientists on that commission. And it seems rather analogous to what we're talking about here. In that case, we didn't require anybody but science, but now we're saying in this case we need only hunters and fishermen, or mostly hunters and fishermen. So I'm just trying to help me out with the line of thought. I hope you recall the
Mr. Chair, Representative, first of all, it's not the total amount of people. It's 5 out of 7 that we're requiring this to be a criteria for. The other thing is we do have an opening for 2 people, which is 2 out of 7, that you can put anything you want on that. They may be academically adept, or maybe they do in fact practice. But when you make up And science is science, and reality is reality at times. We all know that. I would like to see, you know, I don't care on the makeup of the board. That's up to the governor to appoint that. It's confirmed by the Senate. But if the governor wants to appoint a couple of biologists to the board that have never hunted fish in their life, but at least they have the academic background, that's fine. This bill allows that. But I do want at least a good representation of people that not only have a great, and I'm not saying that people don't have a great interest in it, but someone that not only has an interest in it, but practices it as well. Because when you have academics and you have practice, sometimes those are different. And I've seen it, especially, I disagree a lot with what we're getting information out of our Game Commission, because I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing different things, and maybe it's just because I'm in a different area or what, but I'm going to give you a fine example. According to our ODF&W, we aren't losing ground on elk herds, but I used to hunt in the John Day Wilderness area, and when I first went there, I'd see 250, 300 head of elk a year. The last year I was there, I saw 34. Now, nothing earth-shaking really happened there, but something did. So I'm inclined to think that maybe we aren't having the herds. And every year it was a steady decline. That's what was interesting. And it's the same elk over the same area, or they traverse the same draws, the same drainages, but I can see a difference. So I would beg to differ with the Game Commission on that issue, because I've been practical application. And I think that's more important than most anything. Have you ever tried to fish the Rogue River? Sure. You need to have your attorney with you.
Representative Krieger.
I think we need to go back to Representative Reardon's concern about the testimony the other day. That board for the research hatchery originally had, I think, three or four scientists on the board out of the, I think there's nine total. This bill has the voting members saying that they it doesn't preclude them from being a scientist. In fact, three of the non-voting members can be, and they're appointed by the director. He could appoint someone from his own agency, one from Oregon State University, and one federal scientist if he so chooses. He also, in meeting the other slots, could have someone in there who was a scientist, as long as they met the disciplines of what the background they're supposed to have. In this particular case, the problem arose because of the anti-hatchery bias that they weren't doing their job. So what they brought to the table made them unable to do their job.
And for everyone, I want to make that perfectly clear. We're talking about two different issues here.
Yeah.
So, and that's why I asked the question, to try to get some clarification. And so.
Did we answer that as best as we could, I think?
Yes.
Vice Chair Esquivel, does your bill is amended? Let's say I was a member of the public, and I had an interest in a non-consumptive use of our state's wildlife. I enjoy birding. Could I be appointed to the commission?
Sure.
Let's say I have a degree in wildlife biology, and for whatever reason I feel opposed to the concept of hunting. Could I be appointed to the commission?
Mr. Chair, sure you could. It's up to the governor.
Okay. Additional questions or comments? I'm seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to call up Tom Wolf so we can get you on your way. And Tom, before you start, I just want to say I appreciate having received your testimony in advance, and as has been consistently the case for the testimony that you have provided to this committee this session, it is exceedingly thoughtful. And whether we agree or not, I so appreciate the thoughtful nature of your testimony and the fact that you, as much as anyone that I have heard from, is willing to open the discussion around these issues. Thank you for your comment.
I have a question for him.
Please.
Do you have any other ties other than fish?
No, actually, if
you see me earlier, I wore this week a gray, but in commemoration of what we're talking about, I dug out the fish tie.
Excellent tie.
Excellent tie. I do have your tie. I love
this one. So, Tom, welcome back.
All right. Well, thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, and I just want to say that you should have seen my testimony either now or earlier, and Trout Unlimited opposes this bill, but I just want to say Trout Unlimited is a very unique group. We are a conservation group full of hunters and fishers. And frankly, we sometimes conserve and protect wild cold water species and their habitats so that we can fish them later on. So it was a very tough decision for us because I understand the principles behind this. I have been fishing since I was 5 years old and hunting since I was 12, and many of my fondest memories are involved those sports. And many of our members are the same way. They not only partake in conservation issues, but they hunt and fish quite a bit whenever they get a chance. It's the passion that drives Trout Unlimited members. Now, in the body of my testimony, to save time, you've got it, so I'm not going to read it because it's rather long and windy, as sometimes I can be long and windy. But I just want to make two key points to look at is we need to fix the process and make the process so that we have people, as Representative Krieger stated, we want to have the best qualified people on that commission. You know, whether they hunt and fish, whatever, whether they don't, we need to have the best qualified people on that commission. And I think that's, and we also need something that's, we're not doing very well in ODFW that I've seen other boards do better, is if after 4 years, it shows that the commissioner, and they're up for renewal, is not doing a very good job, we need to replace him or her. And we don't do a very good job of that with ODFW. What I suggest is we call together some sort of work group instead of passing this bill. We call together a work group. We look at ways that we can fill these positions, have the best possible representative, meet the concerns of the hunting and fishing community, and look at ways that we can improve this process. The second thing I want to say is, second point, again, this is listed in here. Right now, through either Pittman Robinson or Dingell Johnson, the excise tax, or through license sales, hunters and fishers, according to the ODFW staff that I spoke with, that money accounts for 40% of the money into ODFW. It's a huge amount, whereas, you know, for whatever reason, the birding community, the wildlife community, and it's not their fault, they don't contribute a lot to that. So I have some suggestions listed in here on how we can improve that and how we can look at ways to bring more money in so that we can fund some of those things without taking money from license sales or money from the excise taxes. And, you know, one of the suggestions, just to throw it out here, is to increase the amount of general fund money that goes in the ODFW from 3% to 5% up to at least 10%. Currently, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, 20% of their funding comes from general fund money. We need to look at ways. I'm working with some other groups on a birdseed tax. I'm not sure if that's going to go forward or not, but we need to look at creative ways to look at bringing people together to look at solutions. There's creative people out there. There's good commissioners out there. We need to work at ways to find those people and get them up. And another thing is the hunting and fishing community and conservation community need to look at ways of working together to come up with the best commissioners and best candidates. And finally, in closing, I just like to, even though it's not listed in my testimony and I'm going fast, I want to tell a story. When I was 18 and a freshman at Oregon State, during Thanksgiving weekend, after we ate Thanksgiving, we went up to hunt on a ranch that was owned by people that my father used to coach their son. And it was really a neat November day. We went up there and hunted for quail in the morning and early afternoon, and my brother and I were with my father, and of course at that time I didn't understand the concept that when a covey of quail flushes, you're not supposed to shoot at the whole covey, you're supposed to pick out a bird, and I didn't do very well, but still I got one quail by luck. And in the later afternoon, the Civil War game was coming on, and my father decided that he was done hunting and he wanted to listen to the game. So he sent my brother and I up into these hills, ridges right above there to hunt for Hungarian partridge, which were up there. And I climbed up to the top and got several shots out and got lucky and got one more bird. And I got to the top. I could look out and see this beautiful vista and listen and see hear the game drifting up from the car, even though it was way below me, because it was so clear and so crisp. And I remember that to this day, and this was a long time ago. And I remember a lot of the other things that I've done hunting and fishing. I catching my first trout and a fly on a small tributary in the Tualatin, killing my first deer with my grandfather, catching springers on the Willamette with my best friends. Hunting and fishing means so much to me. It means so much to the members of TU. It is a great passion, and I look forward to many more years of doing it. But House Bill 3437 is not the right answer. There's other answers we can do, and I'm willing to work, and Trout Unlimited is willing to work with other groups and all of you on this committee to come up with answers that takes care of the concerns of the hunting and fishing community. You know, it's not the right answer. You know, we need to look at a solution that is the right solution. The kind of solution that we Oregonians have found so many times, we need to find a solution that deals with this problem and the Oregon solution. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Tom, as always, it's evident that you have given this considerable thought, and appreciate your opening the dialogue very much. Questions or comments from the committee? Yes, Representative Krieger.
I intend, Tom, to tap your knowledge in the future on several issues.
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, thank you so much. And you know, whatever that knowledge is, it's at your disposal.
You're a great Oregonian, Tom. Thank you very much. Anything further? Appreciate it so much. And with that, I am going to close, at least temporarily, the public hearing on House Bill 3437. And I am going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill, what did I do here?
3364.
All right, and with that, I'm going to call up, please, bear with me just a second, folks. Lisa Arkin, John Huddle, and Scott Dahlman, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee, for allowing this public hearing today. My name is Lisa Arkin, Director of Beyond Toxics, for the record. Beyond Toxics supports House Bill 3364 as currently amended in the -1 version. The purpose of this bill is to establish state integrated pest management for our state-owned facilities, from public areas to resource lands. IPM is a long-standing science-based decision-making process that identifies and reduces risks from pests,
John,
and pest management strategies. IPM serves as an umbrella to coordinate the use of pest biology, environmental information, and technology to prevent unacceptable levels of pest damage by the most economical means, while posing the least possible risk to people, property, resources, water, wildlife, and the environment. And lest you think that these are the words of an environmental advocate, I want to let you know that I lifted them directly from the prototypical document on IPM, which is the United States Department of Agriculture's IPM Roadmap, which was published in 2004. IPM originally began in the agricultural business sector. That is because it is a common sense, practical discipline that relies on science's evolving understanding of the life cycle of pests, their ability to inflict damage and economic harm, as well as considerable environmental and medical data regarding the unintended consequences of using harsh chemicals. Pest management systems are subject to constant change and must respond to epidemiological uncertainty as well as respond to the benefits of new technology. Oregon needs IPM to be prepared with the best science for our future. A strong component of House Bill 3364 is the commitment of Oregon State University to provide expert staff, funding, and a legacy of scientific research and knowledge. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recognizes the chair of the Integrated Plant Protection Center at Oregon State University as our state IPM coordinator. Dr. Paul Jepson, who you met today, and other faculty are equipped and ready to provide world-class guidance, training, scientific methods, and a system of metrics to our state agencies. Another strength of this bill is the broad scope of supporters it has earned. You will find medical professionals, pest control companies, people who fish and hunt, rural Oregonians, urban Oregonians, and more. Rural Oregonians stand to gain as much, if not more, from this legislation because rural communities have unique pest pressures that require the best pest management science. The scope of House Bill 3364 applies only to state-owned public property, not to private land or commercial pest control. Yet, IPM is the industry standard. In fact, I'd like to quote one of our Oregon-based pest control companies that currently contracts with the Oregon Department of Administrative Services, and you have their letter in your hands. I quote, "IPM is simply a better way to manage pest problems. The state of Oregon would be well served by adopting IPM as the standard for pest treatment because of the realized efficiencies, cost effectiveness, and risk reductions. Over time, IPM saves money, limits the possibility of human exposure to pesticides, and, in the experience of the writer, is more successful." And that testimony is from Eden Advanced Pest Technologies. In closing, Oregon government already spends millions of dollars in pest control efforts. The problem is both the pests and utilizing the most effective control strategies. And that problem is ever ongoing. The questions before this committee today are, is Oregon going to stay up to date on the science of controlling pests? How are we going to use the funds we are already spending most effectively? And last, how is our government going to be responsive to the needs and concerns of the public? IPM for state agencies is a professional, systematic, and verifiable method, and it is a policy that citizens and government alike can be proud to support. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Thank you, Chair Witt, committee members, John Huddle from the Lapine area.
Welcome.
Thank you. Sorry to walk back in, but I was up till 1 and up again at 6 and needed some coffee. I assume you would like coherent testimony. What I want to report on is the human side of this. What happens when a community is subject to chemical first, reasoning and planning second, or last. In the campaign process of the last campaign, I attended a meeting south of me in North Klamath County where residents were getting together for the first time. They had realized that something had went wrong in their subdivisions. Their subdivision's been sprayed with Outpost 22K. You've got my written testimony. I'm not going to dwell on that, but picloram, which is a major ingredient of Agent White, was the major ingredient in Outpost 22K. Agent White, of course, was used in Vietnam. They first realized that something was drastically wrong when trees, some of which were 250 years old, were dying. They didn't know what was happening. They began to put things together, and they found out that Klamath County had sprayed in there for spotted knapweed. They use the wrong product, the wrong soils, wrong water table, and of course the results were disastrous. But what I want to talk to you about is what I saw going on after they realized that it happened. We had the Department of Agriculture pointing fingers and saying, well, you know, we can't force DEQ to come in and do any investigation on the water. DEQ was saying, we can't, you know, we can't go in unless we're asked. Klamath County Public Health was stonewalling. The Board of Commissioners refused to come up and meet with the residents, citing legal issues. And I'm sure in hindsight that Klamath County probably wished they'd had integrated pest management. Now, I'm aware that this bill won't require that for local agencies, but when you have state agencies taking the lead in doing this sort of integrated planning, I think it will tend to trickle down to local agencies. I don't think anybody in there really is relishing all that they're having to go through with the court process, trying to get you know, redress for the damages they've had. But it was an overkill. They could have addressed the spotted knapweed with something else in the subdivisions there. You know, the problem over there is a matter of trucking in hay and then construction equipment moving, you know, invasive species in. But what they should have done first is engage those subdivisions, the road districts, and the people, and given them the opportunity to address that, and then taken a hard look at, if they need chemicals, is that the right chemical? Clearly wasn't. And there was some serious problems, some of which were never addressed. I tried to get the Department of Agriculture to do a survey to find out, is there a pattern of health problems? Because nearly 50% of the residents in North Klamath County are veterans, and a large proportion of those are Vietnam veterans. We don't know what triggers, what takes them over the edge, you know, what was sitting there as a potent process in their body, and then another chemical kicks in, and now they have cancer. The cancer is back out of remission. So it was, should have been done better. Hopefully, with this bill, if it passes, that won't happen again in another community.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Scott. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Dahlman. I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I will try to keep my testimony as brief as possible for you guys today. As a reminder, OFS is a grassroots coalition of farmers, foresters, and other chemical users. And we are here today speaking in favor of the Dash 1 to House Bill 3364. First off, I would like to thank Representative Kenny Geyer and the Governor's Office for reaching out to a broad coalition to ensure that we had a good, workable, integrated pest management bill to move forward, and we think they've done a good job, and we'll continue to work with them if there are any changes as this moves forward in the process, but want to thank them for reaching out to us. OFS has and continues to support an integrated pest management process and strategies, but we must ensure that all tools are available to be able to manage pests, and we believe that the Dash 1 does allow for that. We also support that the implementing agencies meet on a regular basis to share new strategies, to learn from Dr. Jepson of the latest technologies and strategies that they can use to control pests on their lands. The IPM definition is changed within this from the current statute, and that was probably our biggest concern initially with this. This is crucial because it will determine the efficacy of the IPM moving forward, and although we think that the current definition is sufficient, the definition that is contained in the Dash 1 is something that we are comfortable with. So with that, I will say that we support it with the Dash 1 amendment, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very, very much for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to call up, please, Angela Crowley-Cook.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Angela Crowley Cook. I'm the Legislative Director at Oregon Environmental Council. And OEC supports the passage of House Bill 3364, which will maximize effective, sustainable management of pests, diseases and weeds by strengthening and improving the state IPM program. We're fortunate, as you heard earlier this morning, to have such an amazing resource in Oregon, the Integrated Plant Protection Center at OSU. As you heard, it's nationally recognized. The faculty are at the forefront of IPM research and training to assist pesticide users in more effectively controlling pests while reducing unintended negative consequences. As an example, a recent IPPC, that Integrated Plant Protection Center project, in Hood and Wasco counties have significantly improved the skills in pesticide management, and the users have gained access to the sophisticated pest management mapping websites and climate databases that you saw earlier in the presentation. And since we heard earlier that IPM is being successfully used in Oregon schools and on Oregon's farms, this seems like a logical next step to take to have the state government and the state agencies increase and strengthen their IPM systems. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments for Angela?
I'm not seeing any.
Thank you again.
Yeah.
Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify this morning on House Bill 3364? Not seeing anyone. Again, Representative, tremendous job. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3364.
No, it's just a public hearing.
And I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2783. And committee members, last time we had some questions about commas and ands and ors and those sorts of things. We also had some questions, I think, for law enforcement personnel, and I may be missing something, but I'm going to ask that Scott Begstead, and do you have, is there anyone else that?
Yes, Officer Bob Hayes from Albany Police and Dr. Sherry Morris, veterinarian.
All right, if you'd please come forward. We may have some lingering questions. I'm not entirely sure, but appreciate very much your making yourselves available. In terms of the legal opinion on the bill, we're going to have someone from Ledge Council come and address that specifically. But committee members, this would be an opportunity for us to flush out any of the remaining questions that we had about this bill while we have some experts here. So with that, I open it up to anyone. The sound of silence is deafening. Any quick comments here before Ledge Council comes up?
Sure. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Begstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. I would just call to your attention the fact that this bill really is addressing primarily law enforcement concerns, providing law enforcement with additional resources to take action in dealing with chained dogs, and, of course, the animal welfare concerns that arise from the welfare of the dogs themselves. So toward those two ends, here with me today are Officer Bob Hayes from the City of Albany Police Department and Dr. Sherry Morris, a veterinarian. So I would defer to them, and maybe they could provide some brief comments in support of the bill.
Okay. Very briefly, if you would, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert Hayes. I'm a police officer with the City of Albany. I've been in law enforcement for almost 22 years. Just briefly, I've carefully reviewed House Bill 2783, and I feel it was well-worded and would be easy to enforce The exemptions in the bill appear carefully tailored to keep the bill from being overly broad. It provides law enforcement officers with an important tool to address the problems presented by chronically chained dogs, including excessive barking, biting, aggression, running at large, and neglect. The bill will also be a valuable resource to code enforcement officers. Quick situations where we've come across these types of incidents in the city of Albany is one was a dog was tied to his kennel with about a 5-foot leash, causing it to run back and forth in the mud, run through its own feces, causing problems with its skin and the paws. Another one was a dog that was on a zip line with a plastic collar, which cracked, and as it just ran continuously back and forth, never being let off, the collar basically cracked and was actually sawing into the dog's neck. This bill would be beneficial to law enforcement, the offenders, and especially the animals. The reason I say this is we will be able to address the problems that are associated with chronically chained dogs before they turn into an animal neglect or an animal abuse situation. The Albany Police Department and myself support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Morris. I'm a practicing veterinarian and owner of the Willis Valley Animal Hospital in Kaiser, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I want to reiterate our support for House Bill 2783 and the Dash 3 amendments. The amendments address the tethering of dogs and the use of prong and choke collars when a dog is tethered or chained, neither of which are included in our current law. I understand that at last week's hearing there was a question about the long-term use of prong and choke collars. I would like to offer you my perspective on this subject. Both collars are commonly used as a corrective measure for obedience training to keep a dog from lunging forward or to get it to pay attention. With a handheld leash to get the dog's attention, you would just give a quick pop and release of these collars. Also, any corrective measure should be applied during and immediately after the unwanted behavior so that the dog can associate its action with the correction. Veterinarians do not advocate long-term use of either collar for obedience training, as there are better and more positive tools for working with dogs. In addition, repeated use and misapplication by owners can cause harm to the dog. We also do not support the use of prong or choke collars when dogs are tethered, either short-term or for longer-term tethering. First, neither collar should ever be used on a dog under 6 months of age. Second, dogs with a prong collar or choke chain should never be attached to a tether and left unsupervised. This only invites trouble and possible harm to the dog. And third, a dog wearing either collar can injure itself when it reaches the end of the tether or chain and is jerked backwards. With a prong collar, a dog can injure itself while pulling on the tether and reaching the end of the line. One study has indicated that repeated use of the prong collar can cause high levels of stress and anxiety in dogs. Even more harm can result with the use of the choke chain, such as injuries to dogs' trachea, neck, and back. I've seen multiple dogs over the years choke to death with choke collars on tethers if they get caught on objects. They jump off tables, etc., in the yard. Chains left in place for long periods of time and not put on correctly can actually dig into the neck, causing severe and inhumane wounds and embedding into the tissue of the neck with severe infections. I would like to bring your attention to a letter I brought from Dr. Parsatharaway. He is a veterinary behaviorist in Portland, talking about the behavior concerns with long-term tethering of dogs. Veterinarians are concerned with the possible long-term psychological damage to a dog that wears one of these collars, especially a dog that's tethered or chained in the yard. Veterinary behavior research shows that when tested, the prong collar and choke chains have been found lacking, that they can cause long-term damage and make dogs more reactive, less trusting, and even more aggressive and territorial. An AVMA study noted by the same doctor notes 53% of bites to children by non-family dogs involve territorial aggression. For these reasons, we ask you to support the Dash 3 amendments and House Bill 2783. Thanks for your consideration.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your statements and appreciate your answering our questions. Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
Thank you. This is to the policeman.
Okay.
Would you say you have the ability now to control the situations that you encountered, that you were describing?
Uh,
Chair Witt, Representative Woodson. To an extent, no, because we have to wait for it to fit the level of the crime of either an animal neglect or animal abuse. The nice thing about this bill, it makes it a violation. It's kind of like traffic enforcement. Traffic enforcement is there to promote traffic safety, to reduce traffic injuries and fatalities. This, in a sense, is to enforcing animal safety to reduce animal injuries and animal deaths.
And then I have one other thing. I have heard from a number of my rural veterinarians in my district who are opposed to this bill, saying that you cannot legislate common sense and that they feel they have the ability to prosecute animal abuse now when they have an animal that they come across. So just to let you know that not all veterinarians support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further? I'm not seeing anything. Thank you. Thank you all very much. Appreciate your answering our questions. And we had someone from Legislative Council? Mark and Jessica. Thanks for stopping by. We had questions last time about the construct of the language of our dash threes, and as I recall, Rep. Clem, was it you who called our attention to that? And do you remember what it was?
Yeah, it was me.
Didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I did, so I apologize.
Look at the dash threes.
And a bunch of horses.
Oh, yeah, and I talked about this out in the hall afterwards, and it had to do with the way in Section 2, B, C, and D worked, because it's some semicolons in B, some semicolons in C, and then an or. But all of them, if I remember my conversation in the hall, all of them refer back to one, which is the person tethers a domestic animal. So what I was asking about was, since it doesn't say and in between B and C, could you just get in trouble essentially for having a choke collar with no tether at all? But I think what I figured out later was, because it says tethering up in one, B refers to one, C refers to one, D refers to one, and then tethering is defined in the somewhere else, not in the amendment, but tethering is defined somewhere else as having them on a leash or whatever it is, that it is, they all act independently, that it still has to be tethered, whether it's B or C or D, and it's not, I don't know if I make any sense, it's not B and C, because they all refer back independently to one. So it's not 10 hours and a choking collar, it's 10 hours tethered, or collar that pinches or chokes tethered.
That's as I remember it, Representative Clem. Very good job.
Okay. Anyway, I'm fine.
Please.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee, and Representative Clem, Jessica Menifee, Legislative Council. What you're explaining is exactly right. You really have to read A, B, C, and D by first reading subsection 1. So it's like a continuous sentence. And A, B, C, and D are all alternative ways of committing the offense, if that clarifies things.
All right. Yeah. No A, B, not C.
Okay.
All right. Representative Krieger, please.
For clarification, have you got the bill in front of you there?
Yes.
On the dash 3, go down to 2, a person does not violate this section if the person tethers a domestic animal. Then go down to line 21, which is C, for the purpose of engaging in an activity that requires licensure in the state, including but not limited to hunting. So if you have a hunting dog and he's tethered, you don't have to turn him loose every 10 hours?
Chair Witt, member of the committee, Representative Krieger. Yes, the subsection 2 essentially creates exceptions to the violation. And if you have a dog that is kept for hunting, you are not subject to subsection 1.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, and thanks, Mr. Chair. But on the issue of the hunting dogs,
Representative Krieger, I'm going to, when we bring this bill forward, I'm going to name off the species that this entails, because there's quite a few number of breeds, which, you know, I just thought there were setters and pointers, and boy, how naive, you know. But there are substantial numbers of, example, hounds. It's, there must be 25 hounds that are hunting dogs. So, and I will say that on the floor to get it in the record to make sure that, to ensure that it does include them.
Additional questions of LC?
Sorry.
Yes, Representative Clem.
I'm going to really be sorry I asked this, I think. Okay, so for the purpose of engaging in an activity that requires licensure, that's an exemption. And what about driving?
Chair Witt, Representative Clem, if you look further, subsection 2D, to allow the person to transport the domestic animal.
What I don't want to do is create a loophole where someone claims, well, I have a driver's license and I was driving and so chaining him in the car and leaving him for several hours past what the bill would otherwise allow. Because I think somewhere in here we have something about for how many hours. But I don't want you pulling out their driver's license and saying, hey, nope, I'm good. It's an activity that required me to drive and I had to have my dog in the car for 11 hours.
Chair Witt and Representative Clem, I think because it's modified for the purpose of engaging in an activity, I can't see a situation where you would need to tether a dog for the purpose of
driving. Well, law enforcement officers will tell them, no, sorry, Charlie.
But for the purpose of hunting, obviously you need the animal, so that's how I would read it.
Okay.
All right.
One question. Can say
that. Yes, Representative Reardon?
I'm sorry. I just keep thinking we're done with this one.
Just keep coming back.
So... You talk long enough, I actually started thinking that. 1A, with a tether that is not a reasonable length. Sounds like reasonable would be subject to interpretation. Do we have any understanding, or is there a guideline to, pounds per foot, or pounds of dog per foot of line, or how do we deal with reasonable?
Chair Witt, Representative Reardon, that does allow an amount of interpretation for the law enforcement officer, but it has the qualification reasonable length given the size and available space, and that allows the animal to become entangled in a manner that risks the health or safety. So it has to be two of those things. It still allows for interpretation, but it would have to be to the extent that the animal could become entangled.
Thank you very much. Additional questions or comments? I'm seeing none. Thank you. Appreciate your dropping by very much. And with that, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair McEwen, please.
Chair Witt, I move to adopt the -3 amendment dated March 22, 2013, House Bill 2783.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McEwen moves to adopt the -3 amendment dated March 22, 2013. Discussion on her motion. Yes, Representative Krieger.
Chair, I had a conversation with you about I probably wouldn't support the bill because I didn't see how I would be able to have dogs because I'm just not there, but I do have people that come, feed them, make sure the bedding's right, everything's okay. And I'm giving their doggy biscuit in the morning, their food in the evening. The -3 at the bottom about licensure, they're all hunting dogs. So I'm probably exempt, but I'm concerned about the farm ranch type setting where they may not have a dog that's a stock dog or a hunting dog of that nature, whether or not, and I don't think there's going to be that many of them out in the rural communities, farms, ranches, where I would see them more, that those people probably, depending on their lifestyle or what's going on, may not be able to comply. So I still have a concern about that part of it.
Okay. Appreciate that. One would hope that they'd be able to find time during the day to let the dogs off the run, but there might be that rare exception. Additional discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the adoption of the amendment? Seeing none? So ordered. Vice Chair McEwen?
Chair Whit, I move House Bill 2783 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McEwen moves House Bill 2783 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on this motion. Yes, Representative Clem.
I just want to speak just for a second in support of the motion. As most people who were here earlier know, I'm a huge dog lover. OG used to come to the Capitol with me until they banned him, and he passed away also later. And you know, I've seen an interesting change in people's thinking about animals over time, particularly dogs. So when I first got married to my wife, I went to live with her in-laws on the orchard, and their dog stayed outdoors, roamed the orchard freely, patrolled the property. I bring my Weimaraner into the mix, and first he's outdoors, and he looks real cold out there, and her dad starts feeling bad, and finally he gets to come in. Later, he's in the bottom of my father-in-law's bed every night, sleeping with him. So people eventually sometimes warm up to the little critters and let them in. Now, I'm not advocating that for everybody, but it was either that or my bed, and we'd usually argue over who got them in there on a cold night in the orchard. And so I like the concept of promoting moving towards fencing, moving towards in the house if it's appropriate. I know not everybody's into that, but I'm a supporter of this concept.
Thank you very much. And the record will show that I witnessed Representative Clem day after day after day when the legs were failing on his dog, taking a sling to walk his dog outside every day, above and beyond, actually. Additional questions or comments? Representative Reardon, I think you're next.
Just a brief comment. This is on this committee. It's a real education for me. And a lot of times, and this has been one of those times where I really appreciate the opportunity to learn about, you know, the differences in thinking and differences in understanding of what's appropriate for dogs or other subjects, and how on this panel especially, you know, that urban understanding of the urban rural needs really comes together, mm-hmm. And I think. You know, it's really a valuable experience on either this topic or the other topics as we go forth. So I had no idea that this would go on this long.
Or did I? Neither did the sponsor of the bill.
But it's been a really worthwhile process. So I thank everybody for their work and patience.
Thank you very much. Representative Thompson.
I'm going to support this bill because I think it does give the police a tool that they need. Will be used with some caution. I would be concerned if I thought police departments were going to double the size of their force to do dog inspections, but that's not going to happen. They're not overstaffed, so I look at this as a reasonable accommodation to allow the police, when they hit an egregious brick wall, to be able to have an additional tool. And in cases that I'm aware of that I think this would apply to, it's not something somebody did today. It's something somebody's been doing for months. The neighbors know about it, the complaints are numerous, and there just isn't that extra element of abuse to be able to, for the police to take action clearly unless they park a patrol car there all day. So this, I think this is the right direction.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chair. I too have some apprehensions about the way the bill was going. And I had made some commitments that if we could get the Hunters Association taken care of and the sportsmen, that I would support this bill. I can't explain what abuse is, but when I see it, I know what it is. Yeah. I guess that's the best thing to say. Most of these cases you'll find rural Oregon will not be part of it. Most of the cases you're going to find will be in urban areas. I've seen dogs that have been on a 15-foot chain that had no food or water, they had no house, and they were just in a mud hole from constant walking around. That's abuse. It's unfortunate that we have people that are irresponsible with pets, because I'm the type of guy that I can watch the emergency rooms for people, but I can't watch the one for dogs. because I just can't do that. I would make a terrible vet, trust me. So I'd probably make a pretty decent doctor, but this bill has some people believing that it's the nose of the camel in the tent. I share some of those concerns, but I think Representative Witt, the sponsor of this bill, has done an excellent job with bringing people together, Oregon Hunters Association. I think we've appeased the Oregon Outdoor Council when we read the types of dogs that this includes and the hunting part of it. So I think we should move forward.
Thank you, Vice Chair Esquivel. Vice Chair McEwen.
Chair Witt, thank you. It's been, as Representative Reardon said, it's been interesting to watch the evolution of this bill, and I appreciate the thoughtful work that's gone into it, and I appreciate the people that have come to testify on the bill. My husband and I have working dogs. We have hunting dogs, and we have anywhere between 3 and 5 at a time, and it's something that we care deeply about. We kennel and have our dogs in the house the vast majority of the time. So tethering isn't an issue for us, but I think it's important for our officers out in the field to have that just one more little tool to make sure that if there is an abusive situation that you can deal with it effectively. And for me, I just see this clarifying something that you've already been able to do, but it gives you just one little step further to make sure that people are being responsible in how they care for their animals. So I appreciate everybody's work on this bill.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair McEwen. Last opportunity here.
Can I say one quick thing?
Representative,
when it comes to the working dogs, I mean, the dogs we had on our farm, we never tied them up because there was nobody around. I mean, I think to your concern about the dogs that might not fit into some of these categories that we've already exempted, I mean, we never had a problem. We never had time up because the closest neighbor is a quarter mile away. It's just it's just different. And so I do think it's more of this is an urban problem that we're addressing, not a rural problem. Because I think most people in the rural areas use their dogs for work, and they treat them with care. So for what it's worth, I just wanted to throw that in.
All right. Thank you very much. And with that as a final comment, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair McEwen. Oh, you made the motion. Excuse me. I'm sorry. With no further discussion, Maria, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Whitford.
No. Representative
Unger. Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Vice Chair McEwen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes. And I will assign myself to carry the bill. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2783. I'm going to open a work session. Okay. We're waiting on one of our colleagues. So I'm going to go back and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3437. And what did I do with the sign-up sheets? Here we go. Full-time operation, shuffling paper up here. I'm going to call up, please. Try and make sure we get some balanced testimony here. I'm going to call up, please, Jim Myron, Al Elkins, and Brian Postnitz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I'm here today to talk in support of House Bill 3437. I sent out an email to some of our members asking them for input on why they wanted to support this bill. And they said that they would like to have people that commissioners that have experience in the field hunting and fishing, because whatever decisions they make impacts these. These are the big game regulations. They're 100 pages in length. And every time a decision is made, it impacts what a sportsman or sportswoman does in the field, no matter what they are doing. These regulations are based on this Oregon Wildlife and Commercial Fishing Codes booklet that has 300 pages of laws and regulations that regulate hunting and fishing activities in Oregon. So whatever the commission does, it does impact those in the field, and those in the field want to make sure that those commissioners have had experience and know that the decisions they make will impact those sportsmen and sportswomen in the field. Over the past number of years, I've attended most of the commission meetings around the state, and I've listened to such topics as the size of barbs on hooks that the commissioners were discussing, center fire rifle ammunition requirements, trap distances from public paths on private and public lands, and even discussions on the number of crab pots in boats. So the commission's universe is all-inclusive for fishing and hunting, and we think it's important that those that are in the chairs making those decisions are in fact experienced and know that their decisions will make an impact of those sportsmen and sportswomen in the field. We also support the amendments that were brought forward today. Thank you. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Brian Posowitz. I live in southeast Portland. I am here today just as an average citizen. I'm not representing any group or organization. I'm here in opposition to House Bill 3437. By way of background, I grew up hunting and fishing in Montana. I came to Oregon to attend Willamette University across the street. I've lived in Oregon permanently since 1984. I have had a hunting or fishing license or both through approximately 2007, and at some point I just decided to start enjoying the outdoors without hunting or fishing, but I still care very, very deeply about management of fish and wildlife in the state. I also do legal work in relation to water rights, and in that process I've interacted with the Department of Fish and Wildlife in the role they play in that process, which is becoming significant. They're sort of the experts on conservation in the water rights process. I think there is a concept in the law that the fish and wildlife belong to the state, and that the state is supposed to manage the fish and wildlife as a trustee in trust for all of the people of the state. I don't think there is a distinction in that concept between hunters and anglers and other people. I think the duty to manage the fish and wildlife extends to all of the people in the state and all of their interests in fish and wildlife. I noted on the Department of Fish and Wildlife's website that 88% of the fish and wildlife in the state are not hunted, fished for, or trapped. And so there's a significant portion of the wildlife in the state that is managed by the state that is not subject to hunting, fishing, or trapping. And I think it's also important, as I just alluded to recognize the roles of the Department of Fish and Wildlife that are not related to hunting and fishing. And in particular, for example, they're the experts on conservation and the water rights process. They speak for the public in general about fish and wildlife conservation, not just in relation to hunting and fishing, not just in relation to species that are hunted and fished. So I think given all of the above, it doesn't seem right to me to say that every member of the commission should be somebody who has had a hunting and or fishing license for the last 10 years or however many years. In fact, I personally think there should be more effort made to have interests other than hunting and fishing represented on the commission. I know the point has been made that the argument I hear mostly in support of this concept is that the majority of the revenue comes from hunting and fishing licenses. And I guess what I would say about that is I'm aware of that. I've witnessed kind of how that, in my view, impacts things. And it's sort of an unfortunate situation because I think at times it biases some of the policy decisions in favor of generating more hunting and fishing license revenue. But I understand that's probably going to be the case for a while. But I would also say I don't think it necessarily follows that the source of the revenue is who ought to be represented in policymaking. I don't think, for example, that we say the people who pay more taxes get more representation in government than people who pay less. And I think we also need to keep in mind this significant amount of Department of Fish and Wildlife revenue, which is not license generated. I was looking at the website last night, and what I saw said about a third of the revenue comes from hunting and fishing license sales. So two-thirds comes from other sources, and those other sources ought to be represented on the commission as well as just the hunters and anglers. And thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. Hi, Jim. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Jim Myron, and I'm here today representing both the Native Fish Society and Water Watch of Oregon. The organizations I represent both oppose this bill, and we do so because of the fact that even though a majority of our members of both organizations are either hunters or anglers, we don't think that this is the right policy call. And if you look at the history of the membership of this commission, I think under the current authorities, almost all of the members have had either a fishing or hunting license. I can only think of one that hasn't in recent memory. So it doesn't seem like this is a major problem that needs to be addressed. So from that standpoint, it doesn't make a lot of sense to us. I'll just point out the statute that provides the primary direction to the Fish and Wildlife Commission. All members of the commission shall represent the public interest of the state and make decisions affecting the wildlife resources of the state for the benefit of those resources. That's a pretty clear direction that commissioners can't go in there with their own personal biases and vote their personal biases. They need to look at the broad public interest. And if you narrow it down just to the user groups for having a seat at the table, that's the wrong direction to take. So thank you. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for any members of this panel?
Thank you.
I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Next, I'm going to call up, please, Stan Steele, Joe Rowlater, and Mike Dykesule, please. And as folks come up, since we're running short on time, if you could summarize your statements, and if there's new information, tell us the new stuff, and if you agree with something that's already been stated, if you can just let us know the Reader's Digest version, we'd be appreciative. Thank you very much.
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, my name's Joe Rowlater. I represent Seafood Oregon and the McKenzie River Guide, so I represent most of the professional fishermen in Oregon. I think people who are being managed and who are paying the bills right now for fish and wildlife management have lost confidence in the commission. The last five members that have been appointed to the commission were appointed in a very non-transparent manner, and I've been really on the inside of this. I actually probably had the potential names 5 minutes before everybody else, but I got them the morning of the hearing. And I'll tell you why. Tom Wolf had a really good idea, and I think that's probably a great idea. But I want to tell you why I think it's important for those of us who are being managed and paying the bills to have confidence in the Fish and Wildlife Commission. In the 1980s, we experienced an El Nino situation. Ocean productivity dropped. The ocean was clear. We were out there fishing commercially, and we were fishing at the level that the scientists told us to fish. But all of a sudden, people realized there weren't any gravid hands coming in with the rockfish catch. That's because, well, it turns out we were over-harvesting the older, bigger hands, and there was no recruitment coming up, and we have a space in our rockfish population right now where there are almost no fish from about 20 years old down to about 15 years old or 10 years old. And when that all happened, we had $600 million ex-vessel value on groundfish in Oregon. And we
we all, I mean, we griped a little bit, but nobody said that the commission was unqualified to make the decision to reduce our harvest. And we went to the Management Council, we went to the Fish and Wildlife Commission, we had our say. We reduced that fishery down to something like $90 million a year in excessive value. And none of us revolted. We had confidence in the commission, and I'd like to see that restored. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Stan Steele, Oregon Outdoor Council. And I won't go over a lot of what's already been said because there have been some great points made about why we feel this amendment and bill in itself needs to be considered. But I do want to talk about a recent, the most three recent appointees to the commission. We were all gathered up here in the Capitol for something else that morning, and all of a sudden we were pulled in by the governor's staff and said, we want you to come in, I think, this specific hearing room and meet these commissioners, these nominees. It's the first time we had heard about them, and it's really discouraging to us as 700 to a million anglers, hunters, and fishers to have 2 to 3 minutes to meet the people that are going to discuss our passions, how we're going to administer those. So we really do feel the process and the growing angst with the process in the outdoor community is what causes bills like this to occur. Another thing that is real interesting is we've heard the ORS mentioned several different times. We can give the different sections of the ORS, but the ORS clearly states this, that when a commission seat is open, or coming open, the governor is supposed to appoint the new commissioner prior to that seat expiring. That is not what's been occurring. We've had numerous commission seats open, or, in other words, the current residing commissioner has continued to sit in the seat for over a year. Clearly, it does not appear that the will of the people is being followed on that portion of the ORS. And so we currently have an open seat right now on the commission, if I understand that. Mm-hmm. ORS says that that should not be occurring. So is there just something going on here that we're not aware of? Is it just because everybody's so busy that our important matters aren't deemed as important enough to tend to? We don't know, but it does concern us. The point of why we would need 5 or 7 people who have hunted, fished, or trapped, or whatever that commercial fish background some has is this. We clearly have a passion for preserving Oregon's wildlife. There's a reason that the Western Bluebird boxes are put up throughout the Willamette Valley. There's a reason that hundreds of thousands of hours, volunteer hours, have went into restoration of non-game species by Oregon's hunters, fishers, and anglers, trappers. So in closing, this is not a bad bill. The concept is absolutely superb because we've deviated from the mission of the commission. And what we're asking for, let's get back on course and give us good governance. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mike, before you jump in, gentlemen, I apologize. I'm going to have to juggle our schedule here once again. If you just stand down just for a moment, we'll be right back with you, okay? With that, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3437, and I am going to open a work session on House Bill 3086. And like to call forward, please, Representative Benson, anyone he would like to have join him. And before you get started, Beth, could you remind us what this bill is about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is House Bill 3086, and it's a bill that addresses potential effects on core area sage-grouse habitat and mitigation proposals for such projects. There is a Dash 4 amendment in your packet. There's no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement, which is also in your packet.
Very good. And I guess that fiscal statement means that if we were to send this bill any place, it would be on its way to Joint Ways and Means.
They have requested that, yes.
Oh, wonderful. You may want to comment on that, too, Representative Benz. Please feel free. But we probably could use a little education on the Dash 4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cliff Benz, District 60, and thank you very much for hearing this bill, and thank you very much for interrupting your schedule to fit mine. This Dash 4 amendment is designed to allow a person who wants to do something in most of Eastern Oregon, which has been or is in the process of being designated core sage-grouse habitat, this bill would allow a person who is trying to do something in that area that requires a permit of some sort from a state agency, and if that state agency has asked for help or direction from ODFMW, and if that state agency isn't hearing back from ODFMW, then the person asking for the permit can file a report with ODFMW stating whether or not the area that they wish to engage in this activity upon is or is not critical habitat for the grouse. Upon receipt of that report, ODFMW is given 30 days to respond. The concept is that people have been trying to do things out in my area and nothing's been happening. They've been waiting for years now trying to do something and nothing's happening. So this bill is designed to at least prompt a response from ODFMW. Now, this bill will only work if another bill passes, 2106, which has in it the measure of mitigation. And that bill, as you know, is being heard by land use. The concept there is to design a mitigation methodology that could then be applied by ODFMW upon receipt of a request under this bill for a response to a report. The two bills work in conjunction with each other. The hope is that these bills would both pass, and the 2106 bill suggests that a work group put together the mitigation strategy sometime before the first of next year. This bill would not be effective until the first of next year.
Okay.
So at that point then, the two working together would allow people to do something in my part of the world. And this is, I cannot say, Mr. Chair, how happy I am you chose to hear this bill and how much I hope the committee chooses to move it. Now, as to its subsequent referral, I am unhappy with that. I have no idea what will happen if it goes two ways and meet. I would hope that they would do something with it other than allow it to die, as is the case with many of my communities, as we wait for this type of a tool to try to make something happen. So nonetheless, things are as they are, and we have to do what we're told to do, I suppose. But I would very much hope you would move this bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And if you'd hold on here just for a moment. This was this, Beth, a recent request to a joint Ways and Means?
Yes.
Representative Benz, I would allow for the case to be argued that this doesn't need to go to joint Ways and Means. However, the clock is ticking, and I don't have an answer necessarily for the best way to proceed here, and I'd look for your guidance or anyone else in the audience who might have a comment. Greg Peden, do you have some thoughts about this?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Can I ask a question? We don't have a fiscal on it, right?
No, there is a fiscal statement.
How much was it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Peden. Testified on this bill when you had the hearing. The intent of this bill is to move up in the permitting process the decision making timeline on whether a bill whether a project under in core habitat area can be mitigated or not. And the point here is that you can have a project in core habitat area that you start through the mitigation or the permitting process today. That mitigation process could take a couple of years, that permitting process could take a couple of years and cost you several million dollars. And then you get to a mitigation determination that could say, you know what, this project is not mitigatable and you're dead in the water. All we're asking is that that determination be brought up to the beginning of the permitting process so that a project can know before they spend all that time and money whether they even have a chance to go forward if a project is can be mitigated or not. I'm a little bit confused as to why just moving it up and doing essentially it's the exact same work, it's just moving up the timeline in that process, why that would trigger any new fiscal impact on ODFW or anybody else, given that it's really the same work they're doing today. It's just it's just moving around the timing sequence of it. Regardless of that, I have spoken to the Ways and Means chairman, subcommittee chairman on this bill, who I would assume this bill would go to, and I look forward to a positive conversation with him.
Gentlemen, the possibility, I mean, there's the every likelihood that I could carry this work session over, affording an opportunity of a few days to go plead your case that we really, I mean, I don't understand why this is going to joint Ways and Means. I'd be willing to do that. I recognize that you probably haven't had an opportunity for any thought about this. I can carry it over, or I can send it to Joint Ways and or we, as a committee, could send it to Joint Ways and Means. And I think our committee, having heard this bill, is willing to try and assist with the passage of this bill the best route that you would prefer. So.
Mr. Chair, we would very much like to take advantage of your offer and take the couple of days.
All right. All right. Committee members, since we are in work session, is that generally okay with everyone? All right. With that, I'm going to carry over the work session on House Bill 3086 until next Tuesday. Thank you very much. And with that, we're back on the public hearing on House Bill 3437. Gentlemen, if you please come back, I apologize. And Mike, as quickly as we can.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Deichsel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'm also a member of the Department of Fish and Wildlife's External Budget Advisory Committee, and I'm also a part of a handful of folks here who are pretty much regulars at Fish and Wildlife Commission meetings. I'm right there with Stan as far as being in the room, how the last appointments came about, the timing involved. I apologize in advance. I'm kind of coming to the dance a little late here with an idea, the concept, whether it's 5, 7, 1, or 2, but the representation of the hunting community. And I'd also put out the thought for one member, at least one member, being a representative of the landowner community who provides wildlife habitat to the state's diverse wildlife populations. One of those five people, and most of our landowners or landowner representatives are likely to have a hunting or fishing license, so it could very well be one of the five. So I just put that idea in your docket there.
That's good to do.
Very good. Thank you. Questions or comments? I know that Vice Chair Esquivel likes that idea. I think there are several of us that do.
Yeah, I like that idea.
I apologize for bringing it up late.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And next, I'm going to call up, please, Sue Marshall and Robert Clavens, please. And if you could, to the extent that you can focus on new things and just...
Yeah, I've got a Cliff Notes version for you.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Yep. Representative Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Clavens. I'm the wildlife advocate for Oregon Wild. We're a conservation organization that represents over 10,000 members around the state. I haven't hunted in the better part of the last decade, and I haven't gone on a birdwatching trip in the last 3 years, but I haven't stopped caring about wildlife. Due to the nature of this hearing, though, I think it's important to note that Oregon Wild was founded in 1974, in part by a group of elk hunters concerned about the loss of big game habitat. Our membership, staff, and board still include people from around the state who are avid hunters and anglers. Interstate wildlife is a major driver behind Oregon's flourishing outdoor recreation economy. According to the Outdoor Industry Association, that industry generated nearly $13 billion in consumer spending, 141,000 direct jobs, and $955 million in state and local tax revenue. Only about 10% of that comes from hunting and fishing. However, less than 5% of ODFW's funding comes from Oregon's general tax and lottery dollars. There's no doubt that ODFW is facing very serious challenges, but they require real solutions. We agree and believe that the majority of Oregonians would agree with us that funding for the agency from the majority of non-consumptive interests should be dramatically increased, but that's not going to be the case if they feel the agency is being co-opted by a single user group. Along with the funding leverage, the most vocal in the hunting and fishing community have also long enjoyed disproportionate power over the agency. Folks who care about songbirds, otters, wolves, and wolverines have felt left out for a long time. I sympathize with Mr. Steele's testimony. However, we didn't even get 3 minutes with the recently appointed members of the commission. To be clear, hunters and fishermen deserve a seat at the table, but we all have a stake, and we all deserve a voice. To solve ODFW's legitimate funding problems, we have to build a broad consensus around the public, along the agency's mission, use of good science, and accountability to all Oregonians. We need to build a broad public consensus that what ODFW is doing is important and relevant, that ODFW represents the values of all Oregonians, most of whom are more concerned about songbird decline and habitat loss than filling an elk tag. ODFW's decisions are grounded in sound science, and that everyone from an elk hunter in Eugene to a bird watcher in Burton sees value in funding the agency. As a number of people here have already said, wildlife in Oregon are supposed to be managed for all Oregonians, not just the lucky few, those of us lucky enough to live near the big wild places, or those who choose to hunt and fish. We'd urge the committee to shelve this discriminatory legislation and instead work with a broad coalition of stakeholders for meaningful, long-term solutions to the very real challenges faced by ODFW. The problems we're facing here in Oregon are not unique, but if we focus on common ground collaborative solutions, Oregon can come to unique solutions that can serve as a model to states around the country. That's a conversation we should be having, and we look forward to being a part of it.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions or comments? Yes, Representative Klein.
Where do you come up with your figures on the number of people worried about songbird decline versus this elk, whatever it was you said?
I guess I don't have a statistic to back that up. I think it's pretty fair to say most people are concerned about conservation that goes beyond just the 12% of species that are hunted and fished.
Hmm. All right. You can give me a source later. Once you've got it, I'll be happy to see it.
Anyone else? Rob, if you'd be willing to share some of the high points of the discussion that you would like to have, maybe in an email or whatever to us, I'd love to see
it. Sure. We have a number of concrete solutions that we'd be happy to share, and I think the broader conservation community does as well.
Thank you very much. We'll look forward to that.
Thank you.
And I'd like to call up lastly Bob Olson and Brian Pasco, please. And you've each got a maximum of 2 minutes, so I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob Olson, Northwest Steelheaders. Primarily, I wanted to thank you all for having this discussion. This is an opportunity to comment on a very significant proposal that's been advanced, and it merits attention. The bill underscores the importance of having commissioners who are well-connected to stakeholders, especially the people who are buying the licenses. The big question is, how do we best achieve the desired result? The bill has already generated serious discussions about a more coordinated effort by hunting and fishing groups to advance well-qualified, well-connected candidates, and I think that will be very useful. I also wanted to add the information about the budget. I think if you add in the everything paid by the licensees, including the special taxes, it's over 50% of the budget of the department, and so I wanted to make that clarification. Thank you very much for having us here.
Great job. Thank you.
And I will be just as succinct. My name is Brian Pasco. I am the director of the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club, representing our approximately 20,000 members and supporters here in Oregon. With all respect to Representative Esquivel, regrettably, I'm here to express some pretty serious concerns about the bill as drafted and as amended. But before I do that, I just want to quickly reiterate some testimony that I provided before this committee earlier this session, which is that my organization is not pro-hunting. It's not anti-hunting. I have folks on my board who hunt. I certainly represent a number of folks who don't. And at the end of the day, our interest is in ensuring that we have strong wildlife management plans that are made by, you know, being made by credible and well-informed people based on the best available science that is out there. I think it goes without saying that hunting and fishing is a historical and cultural and social component and part of the fabric of Oregon. At the same time, I think that we have to acknowledge that hunting and fishing is only a few of the reasons why Oregonians care about and have an interest in preserving wildlife in Oregon. And so we have two primary concerns with the bill. The one is that it essentially elevates one interest group and relegates another interest group to a minority on the commission. We believe that diversity of thought is important to making good decisions, and we're worried that, this proposal moves us in the wrong direction. The other is that it eliminates a substantial number of people from the potential candidate pool to be considered for a majority of seats who would otherwise be extremely well qualified, but they haven't maintained a hunting license or fishing license in the past 5 years. So those are our primary concerns. Happy to have this conversation offline. But at the end of the day, I think we've heard some very valid reasons why we need some changes with appointments to ODFW board. Certainly interested in being part of that conversation. We don't think that this bill accomplishes those goals.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? About 30 seconds worth. I apologize to you for the shortness of time. I am interested in your suggestions, and this would go to everyone who's testified and the general public. If you have some bullet points for us to consider before I meet with our vice chairs here on Tuesday, I would love to see those. And with that, thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3437, and we are adjourned. Thank you very much, committee members.